Are listening to More Talk Radio. My name is Cecil.
I am Celeste, and you're listening on 90.7 FM here in the metro area. If you are in Points South, that would put you at 100.7 FM, and in the Columbia River Gorge, 91.9 FM. This is More Talk Radio, and we are here with today's guest, Sarah Robinson. Care to introduce Cecil?
Ms. Robinson is one of the few trained social futurists in North America, and she has received an MS in Future Studies from the University of Houston. She has written extensively. She's a fellow with the Campaign for America's Future, and she lives in Vancouver, B.C. Thank you, Sarah, for joining us this morning.
Thank you, Cecil. It's good to be here.
Good, good. I was just up visiting Vancouver, B.C. a few weeks ago. Caught lovely weather, strolled in the English Bay, and celebrated the fact that even though we're not necessarily the same country, we both have the same sentiment toward Labor Day.
We certainly do. Isn't that interesting? Canada has a number of the same holidays, though not always on the same day. For instance, Thanksgiving is a week from today. But it's really interesting that we also have Labor Day up here.
Now, in terms of our similarities as a segue, we also have some similar ideas about how we need to protect our government, and one of them is by being aware and alert.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. It's right there in the Canadian National Anthem. We stand on guard for thee.
So with that in mind, I want to introduce you as someone who has said that Americans, U.S. citizens especially, be aware of where we are. I like the analogy you use in one of your articles. It's kind of like being parents in a car, and folks are saying, are we there yet? Are we there yet? And what is the there that we're talking about? Well, your articles, the last three that were in August, revolved around being concerned about a creeping fascism that seems to be clouding our bright future, or what we dreamt of as a bright future. And in your articles, you point out that the change that has come over our more progressive brothers and sisters has not necessarily been a positive one. As a matter of fact, it's become filled with rancor and fear, because it seeks to return us to an older time, a purer time, a time in which we dedicate ourselves to a certain idea in almost a chauvinistic fashion.
That's true. I want to make it clear as we get going to your listeners that I am an American citizen, and I've lived in Vancouver for the last 6 years. So when I use the word we, I am definitely talking about us as Americans, because I am still very much an American. And one of the things, I'm a scholar of fascism, and as a futurist, one of the things I'm most interested in is change resistance. Mm-hmm. And you know, we have to change in order to meet the future. The history of America is a long dialogue between progressives who are seeking change and conservatives who are resisting it. And often these dialogues occur over the same issues over and over again. And we often end up saying the same things to each other. My friend Mike Lux has actually written a book called The Progressive Revolution that outlines this conversation, you know, through the years very well. And there always comes a point, we go through cycles, where the conservatives are ascendant and where change comes slowly, where, you know, the status quo is very deeply reinforced. And then we come to times when the status quo is no longer tenable. It's no longer working for the majority of the people in our democracy. And the system has changed, the economics have changed, the technology has changed, you know, our religious values begin to shift. A lot of things happen, and we're called to move on to the next thing, as we are very much called to do in this particular moment by global warming, by the
economy.
The economy, right? The rising of a new black and brown middle class. Mm-hmm. Things are not as they were 40 years ago. They weren't as they were, certainly not as they were 80 years ago. And it's time for us to the system breaks down and reshifts every once in a while. And we're in that moment. And in that moment, progressives always resurge, because we are the ones who carry the vision of the future for the country. The problem that we're having now, of course, is that conservatives have been, you know, badly repudiated at the polls, and their policies have brought us to ruin, and everybody knows it. 70% of the country, you know, looks around at the economic disaster, and they know who got them there.
Mm-hmm.
And so the conservatives have left are left with, you know, they can't win through the democratic process anymore. And so they're left with nothing more than being able to throw a tantrum and perhaps trying to control the discourse, trying to control the country through tantrum throwing, which is basically what this is. And in some countries it works. And when it works, we call it fascism. When you get a small conservative group of people who make an alliance with the oligarchy, you know, the wealthy corporatists who have lost their grip on power in the face of a rising progressive tide, and who cultivate the rural and less educated people of the country and turn them into a brown shirt horde that uses violence and intimidation to get its political way, that's fascism. That's what that is. And so what we're seeing with the teabag movement is what is the beginnings, perhaps, of that. You know, based on our understanding of fascism as a pattern and a system in history, this is what it looks like. And so when I said, are we there yet, are we there yet, those of us who are scholars of fascism and change resistance know this pattern. And people have been asking us since the Bush administration started, you know, are we there yet? Is this fascism? Because they did so much that was so authoritarian and very scary. And those of us who are familiar with how fascism works kept saying, this is not good, but it's not yet fascism, because that marriage between the oligarchy and the brown shirt horde had not yet been joined. And with the teabag movement emerging, you know, we are seeing that, where we are right up against the line where real fascism begins.
It's interesting. I appreciate you defining fascism early on in our conversation. Oftentimes we hear in rhetoric on talk radio, words thrown to and fro, and one of those words is fascism. Now, the president has been called everything except our engineer mentioned a member of the KKK, but he's been called a fascist, been painted as Hitler. Is this part of the movement of the development of this in terms of the rhetoric and also the blurring of definition?
The F word is a fun word to use because it's so fraught. You know, it's mm-hmm. got just so much intensity to it. So people have loved to throw the F word around ever since World War II. Robert O. Paxton, who first identified the pattern that I talk about here, who's probably the world's leading living scholar on fascism, says everybody is somebody else's fascist because it's just a really wonderfully dirty word to fling at the people who are doing things you don't like. So it's easy to lose sight of the fact that the word fascism has an essential scholarly definition that is very specific and very narrow and doesn't apply to very many cases. So when you know, somebody like me uses the word, we are describing something very specific. It's not just because you know I hate you. It's
yes.
not because you know I think I don't like what you're doing. It's because, as Paxton says, real fascism is, and this is the official definition according to Robert O. Paxton, who is a scholar at Columbia and Oxford, and like I said, has written most of the best books on fascism as a structure. He says it's, quote, a form of political behavior marked by obsessive preoccupation with community decline, humiliation or victimhood, and by compensatory cults of unity, energy, and purity, in which a mass-based party of committed nationalist militants working in uneasy but effective collaboration with traditional elites abandons democratic liberties and pursues with redemptive violence and without ethical or legal restraints goals of internal cleansing and external expansion. So there he has it again. He has the traditional elites collaborating with committed nationalist militants to use violence and to use this imagery of national renewal, national purity, national rebirth, you know, getting back to some golden age that probably never existed. There's also always a lot of that. And they scapegoat others. They seek to cleanse the nation internally and expand it externally. And that's what fascism is.
You mentioned in terms of the development and how it begins. So certainly we can't say it began on such and such a date that this movement began. And you mentioned that for 8 years or so, people have been asking, are we there yet? What are some of the markers in the last 8 or 10 years that tells us where it might be headed in that direction?
Well, we can back up. You know, there have always been nationalist militants in the United States. Paxton makes the case, actually, that the first fascist organization in history was the Ku Klux Klan in the Reconstruction era after the Civil War. that they were really the first ones, where the Southern elites made common cause with nationalist militants from the lower classes to terrorize blacks. And there's always this business of terrorizing farm workers around the country. Around the world, this is a common thread with emerging fascisms. So what we're seeing, the violence against immigrants that we're seeing now, and the whole anti-immigration movement against Mexicans, is very consistent with the theme of fascism. But it's a minor detail, but I find it interesting. But Paxton says that fascism unfolds in five different stages. And in the first one, there's this rural movement that emerges to effect some kind of nationalist renewal. It's a palingenesis. It's the rebirth of the country from the ashes. There's a broken social order. The elites have betrayed them. The intellectuals have lied to them. And they're hurt and they're angry. And it's often very religious and very nationalistic and very emotional. They absolutely throw reason overboard. It's what's in the gut. It's the national truth. It's in the gut. And a lot of national symbols get co-opted. And in America, you know, we have comings and goings of this and have had for a long time. Then as it moves into the second stage, this movement gets real political power. And we sort of saw that with the rise of the religious right in the 70s and 80s, that it takes over a party, took over the GOP, and gets a table at the seat of power. The seat at the table of power, there we go.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't take over the country unless certain things happen. What happens is the country then runs into trouble, some kind of trouble, that the progressive elites aren't yet capable of dealing with. But usually it's such bad trouble that progressives start rising, that the country abandons its right wing and embraces the left. We saw this in Germany when they started to embrace communism,
mm-hmm.
and the fear of that. Drives the people on the right into absolute frenzy. And what happens then is when you get this marriage made, because they realize they can't rule democratically, so they have to rule through intimidation and violence. And that's when this marriage between the corporate elites and the nationalist kind of militants from the lower classes gets joined. And what happened in Germany, actually anywhere that fascism took root, that's really interesting, is they never had more than 25 or 30% of the population.
Mm.
And if you're willing to use violence to intimidate people and take over the democratic process, that's all you need. If you think about a town that has been taken over by a mob, a street gang, a small southern sheriff, we have these images, right?
Yes.
And all it takes is a few goons who are willing to go out and make an example of somebody every once in a while, and you keep the whole populace very, very nicely cowed. And after that, they're not interested in their own liberties and rights anymore. They just want to stay off the goons' radar. So this is what you get. And when that marriage is joined is when begins to succeed in intimidating people with political violence, that's when the third stage begins, and that's where I believe now we are now. And the interesting thing about the third stage is once they start succeeding and dictating the terms of the political life of the country through violence, no country who's ever reached that point has ever turned back from the fascist process. Once you've gotten there, you are on for the whole ride. That ride takes you to a fourth stage, the fifth stage.
You're locked in.
Where you're locked in. You're absolutely locked in, and there's no turning back. In the fourth stage, these people take complete control of the government. The kind of government you get depends on who ends up taking control.
Well, yes, who gets the upper hand.
Who gets the upper hand. And if it's the corporatists, or the elite institutions, which is to say the military, if the military takes control, you get a military dictatorship. If the church takes control, it's a theocracy. Or the brown shirts themselves can take control, in which case you get an authoritarian police state.
Mm.
Whatever you get, it's not a democracy. It's always somebody strong-arming and control. And then what happens from there is that Paxton says that these they're very unstable governments, and they eventually burn themselves out, usually at tremendous cost to the country, as we saw with the various European fascisms.
Well, and then also, if the populace, the brown shirts, as we've called them in this instance, if they get control, not having all of the power, the financial backing, and the infrastructure, it peters out a little faster without as much residual government.
Exactly. Exactly.
So,
but if the corporatists are able to retain control, or set up a strongman government, or the military has a coup and is able to set up a strongman government, you could be in that for a good long time, as we saw in Spain with Franco. Franco was there for 40 years as a military dictator. We've seen this in Argentina, where they had a series of military dictators. those can be very stable for a fairly long time, if the country will allow it to happen. And the hope I have in all this is that Americans as a group don't tolerate dictators of any kind very well. And I think we would come to a point where we would try to throw that off very quickly.
Well, this is a good place for me to interject a couple of things. We do have a couple of callers who are holding, too. You are listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO Portland, 90.7 in the metro area. Our guest today is Sarah Robinson, who is a futurist and a student, and a student with quite a few credentials here behind her name for fascism. If you'd like to join in the conversation, you can do so by dialing 503-231-8187. And then, Cecil, really briefly, I know you wanted to say something.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you to describe in a little bit more detail the third stage that you say we're in. Mm-hmm. And you also mentioned once you're in that stage, there's no turning back.
Right. We're, as I like to tell people, we're in the parking lot cruising for a space. We're not there yet, but we're very close. And we're making choices now, town by town and as a country, that could put us on that path or take it off, depending on how we respond to this uprising on the right. When we're making how we choose to respond to that chooses our path at this point.
And we'll unfold some ways to respond to this, but I want to jump in really quickly right now, Sarah, because we do have a couple of callers online, so we'll go to our first caller. Good morning. You're on the air. Good morning, Jim.
Yes.
Yes.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I just want to have one question of your guest, and I'm wondering if she's read the book called Liberal Fascism by Jonah Goldberg. I'm surprised that there's always an alignment of fascism with the conservatives, and there's a fascism in the liberals, too. And I would like to know if she's read that book, and I would like to recommend that book to your listeners. I'm going to hang up and listen to the answer.
Well, Jim, I want to thank you for bringing that up, because that was one of my questions
that
I wanted to bring up. So thank you. So, Sarah?
Yes. That book was written by Jonah Goldberg, who is not a scholar of fascism and has absolutely no credentials in the field. It was an attempt, a blatant attempt, by people on the right to deflect this label from themselves. It has been debunked by a number of historians in the field, and it's newspeak. Fascism, as it's been understood for 70 years, the 70 years that scholars all over the world have been studying it, has always been understood as a phenomenon of the right. There is such a thing as left-wing totalitarianism. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Stalinism, Maoism, Castroism, these are all right-wing totalitarian or left-wing totalitarianisms. So nobody doubts that. But what Goldberg did was he didn't define the word very clearly. He conflated fascism with totalitarianism, when really fascism is a subset of totalitarianism, and very specifically one that occurs on the right.
Well, Sarah, can you explain what it is? What are the components of fascism that make it a development out of the right?
There's an authoritarianism to it that is very, very much right-wing. There's a social psychologist named Robert Altmaier up here in Canada, as a matter of fact, at the University of Manitoba, who is the world's leading authority on authoritarianism, and he's done a lot of the studies that about the authoritarian personality in politics. And what he found was that there are personality traits that make one embrace an authoritarian model of the world, and makes you want to follow, and feel more comfortable when you have a strong leader that you're behind. And what Altmaier found in his studies that was so remarkable was that 75 to 80% of the population who has this trait gravitates toward right-wing politics. Because progressivism, just inherently, believes in the goodness of human beings, tends to trust people to make their own way, expects us to cultivate our own internal sense of authority, that we make our own rules, and to function in a democracy the way our Constitution was written, the way our founders expected us to. They wanted us to think for ourselves and make up our own minds and research things and apply the tools of reason and then vote accordingly. And authoritarians, and this is, according to Altmaier, 20 to 25% of the population, would rather not do that. They want to see the world in very black and white terms. They want somebody to set hard rules and make them follow them. So they want strong leaders. They're far more comfortable falling into some kind of system where there's a strong leader who will tell them what to do, keep them out of trouble, and tell them how to vote, how to think, what to do, because they don't feel competent to do it themselves internally. So it's an external leadership that they're looking for, and that impulse, that looking for a leader who will take you by the hand and lead you through life, tends to lead people into right-wing thought processes because there are rules, customs, traditions, ways of doing things that are right, have been proven right by other people, and you can trust them. And that's the belief on that side. And so people, you know, people who have that leaning will tend to right-wing politics overwhelmingly. And fascism, as you can tell, it's a very top-down authoritarian sort of way of governing, perhaps the most authoritarian way of governing. And so it's very easy for right-wing movements to fall into it. There has never been a case in history in which a left-wing government fell into it. Although China may be the exception, there's an argument to be made that we are seeing a part, you know, as China gets taken over by its corporate interests. It's no longer a hierarchical state the way it was, a communist state. It's now becoming a corporatist state. And we could see a time in which they forsake left-wing totalitarianism for a right-wing totalitarianism because the leaders are now corporate.
Yes.
Did I track this all right?
Yes, you did. Excellent. And we're going to go
to a long, involved conversation.
Well, it is, and it's really important to get the language right so that we can respond appropriately, because you do map out stages to respond. But we do have another caller online, so we'll go to...
But I would like to say in closing that the book Liberal Fascism is a deliberate distortion and distraction. A lot of people on the right believe it, but it is a wholly fabricated, it's a whole new idea in 70 years of fascist studies, and it does not comport with anything that is in the scholarly literature. It's hard to overstate how a complete breach and break it is with how this phenomenon has been understood by Hannah Arendt and Umberto Eco and Roger Griffin and Robert Paxton and all the great scholars of fascism that have been at this since World War II.
Thank you for debunking that. And we have Brian. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning. Liberal fascism, it sounds like something Ann Coulter would come up with. I have a couple of questions and then a kind of a statement. But are Canadians as ignorant of the differences between fascism and communism, say, because they chuck them all around in the same breath here? And I met this Canadian couple recently in a bar here, and had a most wonderful conversation with them about everything from healthcare, and they taught me a few things I didn't know about the Canadian system, but just also their general awareness of what was going on here in the world in general was extremely refreshing. So I wondered if there was the confusion there between the different types of totalitarianism, or they just chuck them together and use them as a weapon like they do here. I suspect not, but I'd like to hear your take on it.
Canadians, we're talking about Canadians?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
And let her
get that one first, and then we'll come back to you.
Yeah.
Right, okay. Just wanted to clarify before I launched into it. The living here in Canada has been a real revelation for me as an American. Just getting the perspective, I live 50 miles off the border, and just that big 50-mile step back gives me a really different view on how America behaves with regard to the rest of the world, how it's seen by the rest of the world. And I think Canadians have generally a much more global sense of things because they are far more aware of, it's a small country, and they are part of the community of nations and very much more dependent on the community of nations and Americans who kind of exist in their own bubble, their own economic and informational and political foreign policy. You know, when America acts, everybody in the world is affected, and most Americans have no idea the degree to which other people are affected. Mm-hmm. Canadians know this. And of course, Canada has more immigrants per capita than any country on earth. And
really? I didn't know that.
So it's a very cosmopolitan country, and that adds to a tremendous awareness of how the rest of the world works. They travel tremendously just to get away from the weather, I think, sometimes. But it's common for kids graduating high school to go abroad for a year and work. They call it the gap year, and most Canadian kids do it. So there's this awareness of how the world works that you see up in Canada that you don't see in the United States, and that it pleases me greatly. As to whether or not the average Canadian would know these particulars about fascism, I don't know. I really don't know. I don't know that their political education on it is any more better or different than what Americans get. There seems to be widespread confusion about this word. It's a very difficult word to use. Whenever I write about it, I get all kinds of different reactions, and mostly by people who, you know, who don't, you know, I always put the definition right in there, and some people skim right over it. Oh, I know what she means, and they don't. So part of what I'm trying to do here is reclaim the word from people like Jonah Goldberg and put its traditional scholarly definition back on it and make people aware that we cannot use it indiscriminately, because when we have situations like the one we're in now, we need to be able to get that word out and use it to tell people what's going on.
Well, I suspected as much, but I just wanted to hear it from somebody who, you know, that had seen both sides of the border too, on an extended basis. And to say, I was most impressed by the recent meeting I had with a Canadian couple who just casually were able to talk about things in a much broader sense. And I really think everybody here should have to travel when they get out of high school too, not just student exchanges, but, you know, that program Kennedy started. The
Peace Corps.
Peace Corps.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, well, thank you so much.
It's still there, you know.
And yes, it is. Well, thank you for your call.
Just one more thing. I lived in Franco.
Really quickly.
Yeah, I lived in Franco, Spain, and it was very like what the Bush regime, you know, you could go shopping and do your stuff and whatever here.
Daily life goes on.
If you crossed the line to the and messed with the system, you were in jail or worse. So it was very like this country under the Bush regime, and I'll let it go of that. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your call.
One of the interesting things I found out, Diana Carey, John Kerry's sister, was up here in Vancouver in 2004 campaigning for her brother. And she told us, the BC Democrats abroad had a meeting and I attended, she told us that American passport holders vote Democratic 3-1. So if you have a passport and you travel, you are 75% likely to vote Liberal. Yeah. Which I thought was a fascinating statistic, and it says something about how broadening travel is and how likely it is to make you to give you a progressive view of the world.
Does that stand up, you know, holding political systems kind of steady? Does that hold up across the world?
I don't know. It was just applied to Americans, but it did say something about the value of travel.
Yes, it does.
Broadening people's views.
I want to continue our conversation by having you tell us, not only analyzing where we are, but also offering maybe a historical or perspective on points of resistance. If we're in the third stage, what are things that countries have done to resist going to the fourth and fifth stage, and are there signs of resistance currently in our nation?
Well, there are short-term things we can do, and there are long-term things, structural things we can do as a country. Short-term, I actually wrote an article about this. In the short term, first thing we need to do is make sure the teabaggers do not win this one or any of these battles. It's being fought at a national level, and we kind of hope that people in Washington are taking care of it for us. Mm-hmm. But the thing to remember about fascism is it's a local phenomenon, that these teabag movements are town by town by town. Mm-hmm. And what we need to do is make sure that they don't dominate, that they don't take control in our town. And all of us need to get out there and do it, because having formed up around the healthcare debate, they're going to be back, and we're going to see them trying to flex some political muscle at the local level. You're going to see them at school board meetings fighting evolution and textbooks and various and sundry things. They may try to get their own elected sheriff, so they can deputize their own posse and have access to the tools to institutionalized violence, to the state violence. These things can and will happen if we don't stand vigilant. So the most important thing we need to do is make sure the teabaggers do not win on this healthcare fight, and do not take any kind of control at the local level. Because they're stopped.
Well, Sarah, that would mean paying attention also to with our rural neighbors. You know, making sure that we stay connected to our rural areas and our rural neighbors.
Absolutely, absolutely. There's a tremendous sense of disenfranchisement among rural Americans. There has been for 100 years. And whenever they get to feeling humiliated or disrespected or disempowered, we are likely to see these kinds of uprisings, because they don't have a lot of power in the formal sense of education or access to media or access to the economy. And so the only power they have is to take up arms. They've got their guns. That's why they love their guns, because it really is, in the end, for a lot of rural Americans, the last best hope they have of achieving political power.
And I'd like to jump in here and mention, here in Oregon, a a project that has been going on for 15 years. I'm struggling against the creeping fascism. It's a rural organizing project who have organized communities throughout rural Oregon on issues such as immigration, taxes, school board elections, and homosexuality issues. So there are organizations here in Oregon that are doing just that.
That's fantastic. I would be interested in knowing about that, because that's exactly the kind of thing that's needed to bring that, you know, kind of the light and the energy and the information into places where it's sometimes hard to come by. I grew up in a very rural stretch of California, and it has a very similar kind of culture and climate even to a lot of Eastern Oregon. And I'm very familiar with that kind of redneck backwoods. Those are my people. Mm-hmm. So, and I have a lot of sympathy for them in their positions. And I know, you know, how disenfranchised they can feel by people in the capital making decisions without much of their input, and that affect their lives in very dramatic ways. So you're absolutely right. Getting those lines of communication open and getting them enfranchised and participating in the system is absolutely critical, because it's when they lose faith with the system that they're willing to go to violence. The third thing is we need to brush up on our nonviolent resistance and leave the heavy lifting to the cops. So when these teabaggers, you know, start this kind of you know, try to shut down a meeting, for example, mm-hmm. or do other forms of bullying and intimidation, rather than bully and intimidate back, which only makes us as bad as they are, we need to enforce the laws that are on the books and let the cops do it. And there are laws against disrupting public meetings and being a public nuisance and being disorderly in public that can be used. God knows the Bush administration, you know, stretched these things until the elastic gave out against people who showed up at Bush rallies mm-hmm. with the wrong T-shirts or with the wrong bumper stickers. You know, we're not going to be like that, because we're progressives and we're better than that. But as long as those laws are on the books, we can use them to very good effect against people who want to keep us from participating in the democratic process.
You're listening to KBOO. Sorry, got to cut you off for just a second here. KBOO, More Talk Radio here on 90.7 FM. Please join in the conversation, 503-231-8187. And Sarah, let me just put a bookmark right here, and we'll come back to some of the other things we need to do. We've got a couple of the callers here online, and so we'll go to them. Good morning, you're on the air. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning. Just a quick question. Is it possible for a complacent progressive middle class, which is divided into a multitude of little nonprofit organizations, to resist the tendencies of which you are speaking?
That's a good question. Thank you.
That's my question.
Are you talking about fragmentation at the local level or the national level?
Well, both, actually.
What?
I think both. Is that what you think, Gregory? I think we lost them. Well, if you could answer for both from your perspective.
I can. There have been really wonderful efforts by local groups to band together. I think one of the great things that's happened with the emergence of the 50-state strategy and whatnot has been that local progressive groups have found each other and are working together much more effectively in coalition when things like this crop up on the local front. And people understand that we have to go to the barricades together. And they, you know, they form meetings and they form strategy. And I saw this in Bellingham, Washington, which is just over the border from where I live, mm-hmm. When the Minutemen came up to town a few years ago to guard the Canadian border. And all the various progressive groups in town got together, had a big two-day meeting, and plotted strategy. And that's, you know, that's what needs to happen. I think it's what is happening in a lot of towns. As far as nationally, one of the things that really encourages me, I'm a fellow at two different think tanks, one of which is the Campaign for America's Future, which is one of the largest of the progressive think tanks in Washington. And one of the things that is happening across the movement is there's increasing synergy and awareness of how we can support each other. And I think it's one of the reasons the progressive movement is rising, is because we are moving away from identity politics and single-issue kinds of stuff. It's still there, but there's a growing awareness that we hang together, we hang separately. And I'm seeing much more synergy between everybody than I have seen in 30 or 40 years. So that's a really exciting thing in my view.
Well, thank you so much. And we'll go to our next caller. Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm well, and you?
Fine. Just fine. And your question?
That is a wonderful show. I'm really curious about documented instances of when the process that you've described has been upset. and what were the factors in upsetting that process in stage 2-3?
This is a really excellent point, and Paxton does make it, which is to say, you know, countries go through stages 1 and 2 a lot, and most of them never make it to stage 3. It takes a very specific set of conditions, you know, to all kind of come together at once for stage 3 to catalyze and take off. And what happens, of course, America has had, you know, the KKK first in the Reconstruction era, and again in the 1920s. In the aftermath of World War I, all of Europe had basically proto-fascist movements going. You had France and then Britain, and all the countries had, and most of them did not become fascist. So obviously, it's very possible for countries to turn back, and more often than not, they do, that's good news. And what needs to happen is we need to make sure that the alliance between the elites and the nationalist militants from the lower classes either never takes place, or if it does try to take place, it's throttled in its crib, basically, that just never quite gets off the ground. And we're at the point now where they're trying to get some success, they're trying to get some air, and so this is why it's important we put ourselves right into the middle of it now and say, no, this is not going to happen this way. The democracy will prevail.
So do we actually have examples that we could study, like specific examples where that process
upset? France, England, America in the 1920s. These are all good places to start.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You're listening to More Talk Radio. We're speaking this morning with Sarah Robinson, who is an authority on fascism. Coming up this morning on KBOO at 9 on the OMO, Max Blumenthal speaks about his new books, Republican Gomorrah, Inside the Movement That Shattered the Party. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, Barbara Bernstein speaks with Liz Pereira, Washington representative for the Union of Concerned Scientists Climate Program. At 11, on Sound of Awareness, host Paul Van Dyke speaks with a local doctor who has studied the sleep disorders of people who are blind. And at 11:30, writer, poet, and naturalist Diane Ackerman discuss her new book, Dawn Light, Dancing with Cranes and Other Ways to Start the Day. All this on KBOO. Right now, we're speaking with Sarah Robinson. Our numbers are 503-231-8187.
So what we were doing was outlining some of the ways in which we can take a stand against this creeping fascism. And you were at the point of just about to mention point number 4, which is to make sure that the media knows what they're talking about and that they do present things accurately.
Absolutely. The truth of the matter is that this whole teabag movement would run out of power with a flick of a switch if the media would just turn off the camera. You know, they thrive on media. It makes them look bigger than they are, and more important than they are, and more powerful than they are. And it lends a legitimacy that they don't deserve, not by their numbers and certainly not by their behavior. So, but you know, Chris, telling the media to lay off a story, you know, high conflict. They love story conflict narratives. They're always looking for where the conflict is. As you know, you're in the media, as am I. And because this is high conflict, high drama, there's no way they're going to turn away from it. So what we have to do in return is just make sure that they get all sides of the story, and that the best cure for bad speech is always more speech.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So we have to bring our own cameras and document things, and get it up on YouTube and get it out in press releases, and make sure that the local reporters especially, because they're the ones who really define the story on the local scene. So the local radio, TV, and newspaper reporters and bloggers all get, you know, all see all sides of the story, and don't just end up telling this, you know, just covering this, you know, the event the way that the organizers of the teabag rally want them to.
As powerful and potent as the electronic media is, how important do you think it is to create face-to-face forums, having venues out in the community where we actually talk? I don't want to use that as a substitute for the media, but just to get that real-time, organic communication.
That's critical. That's the heart and soul of democracy, is people getting together face-to-face and talking about the issues that matter and working through problems together in good faith. And that's what's being disrupted here. is if this, and this is how democracy has always worked in America, at its best, at town meetings and county meetings, and you know, in New England, they still govern their cities by town hall meeting.
Yes,
they get, everybody gets together for 3 or 4 days every year, and they sit all day at City Hall, and they allocate the budget, and they make the bylaws, and they govern the town for the year, which is a fantastic experience for the people who sit through it. Long and boring.
The reason I say that is kind of a segue into your sixth point, which is shutting down people who spew hate talk. There's always going to be some people who are undecided but are still mouthing that line. Is it a good idea to bring them to some of these forums, maybe them have them sit and talk in these forums, those who are still approachable, and have them try to articulate where they're coming from and have a discussion? Or you think that's not possible?
When people are coming to a meeting with the intent to disrupt it,
okay,
and they've been trained and organized, and they've brought their signs, and they're ready to shut down anybody who tries to talk, what you have to do is get them to change their plan.
Mm-hmm.
I had an interesting conversation with Representative Joe Sestak of Pennsylvania, who had town hall meetings in the Pittsburgh area through the summer, and he said that he actually had a very good luck. He was very smart. He got there before the teabaggers, and that's hard to do because the teabaggers, one of the strategies is they get there first,
mm-hmm.
and they get the seats along the perimeter and in the front row, so they're really able to literally surround the conversation. So Sestak got there before they did, and so when they came into the room, he was already there holding the space, and he shook their hands, and he talked to them and as human beings and made a human connection with them that largely diffused the meetings. By the time the meeting started, they didn't have the taste for it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very pleased with himself, and rightly so, for having mm-hmm. figured that out. But he's a good politician. I think that's a technique that can be used, for instance, by a lot of politicians who are trying to control the debate and control the room a little bit more and make sure that the people who came to speak have the upper hand over those who came to shout.
So in just plain language, basically what we're talking about is make that human connection, break the groupthink.
Right, exactly. And Sestak's a very brave man, and he on the strength of his charm, he just charmed every one of them as they walked in the room. And by the time the meeting started, they just had no juice left for it. The other thing about it, and I wrote this article back in August before the Color of Change campaign against Glenn Beck.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
It had really, really gotten air.
Mm-hmm.
But I wrote about shutting down the hate talkers. And this is what Color of Change did with Glenn Beck. You know, they've got 65 advertisers, $500,000 a day, that Fox is not getting anymore off of his show. And this is a technique that's actually been in use for several years on a regional level. I have a friend in San Francisco, a blogger, who got Melanie Morgan, who is KSFO is the biggest talk radio station, right-wing talk station in San Francisco, and this woman named Melanie Morgan was their biggest talker, highest ratings. And he got her off the air by doing exactly the same thing. A small group of people can really clean up the local airwaves, the radio airwaves, simply by going to the advertisers, and these are often small businesses in a small town. And look, I'm not going to use your cleaner. I'm not going to bring my car to your shop or whatever, you know. And not even threaten boycott, but just say, is this what you want your product associated with? And,
yes.
Play them some clips.
Yes.
And this is what they're saying on shows you're paying for. Do you want your product associated with this? And most of them will say, I had no idea. Heck no. And pull their advertising. And this is how we get the hate talkers off the air. And rural America radio, as you know, is going all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
So this is how we change that climate. And it really literally changes the atmosphere, the political atmosphere of the country, if we do this.
Well, I do want to get the last point that you have. And then we have a link on the More Talk Radio webpage here on the KBOO site where people can access your articles. And so we also want to bring up the fact that you do have another article written at the end of August, which is 5 ways to build a fascist-proof America. But to get
right
back to the 7 ways we can fight back, because right now we're engaged in the actual battle, what would be your closing points to that?
The most important thing to remember is that the democracy that we have was naturally built as a system to be extremely resilient, to have natural immunity to any kind of totalitarianism. And that's one of the great blessings of our democracy, is that things usually don't go too far off the deep end. Before the 70% of really kind of normal mainstream Americans will go, no, that's farther than we want to go, and we're going to pull it back, and they do. And I have a certain amount of confidence that that's what's going to happen this time, that mm-hmm. most of America is looking at these tantrum throwers and saying they have no seat at the grown-up table until they knock it off. And I think we're coming around to that. And if we do, that's a very good sign, because it means they will not get power over us or over our discourse. So we need to do things that will restore the working class and the nationalist militants, that, you know, the class of people who are joining with the corporatists. We need to get them back on our side. We need, as you said, we need to reach out to them. Passing health care would be a huge coup, because most of these people are really suffering. Raising minimum wage, getting Employee Free Choice Act, things that will materially better their lot in life and restore their trust in the government, so they don't have to resort to violence or intimidation to get what they need from the government.
Well, let me ask you that, because I think those on the right are usurping this group by people who would benefit by national health care and raising the minimum wage in very strange ways. So how do we get them back on their side, rather than them saying, I don't want government taking over my health care, or mm-hmm. seniors who are afraid that Medicare is going to go down the loop?
Or right. Ask them to do things, you know, to end their life and their options.
Right. Hey, we've definitely allowed the right wing to co-opt that conversation with absolutely absurd lies. Hitler talked a lot about the big lie, Goebbels, about how you say something big enough, absurd enough, and it mm-hmm. puts down
often enough
defense.
Yes.
And so now they're explaining, you know, if you're explaining, you're on defense. Mm-hmm. And the Democrats have been kept on defense because they have to defend against these absurd charges, you know, death panels and, you know, all of this. This is, you know, ridiculous. But I think people are starting to get clue. Certainly, okay. I wrote this, you know, 6 weeks, 8 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And I think just even in that time, more and more Americans, and especially the media, have begun to realize that this kind of talk is marginal,
okay.
and it doesn't serve the country well, and we need to get on with a more serious conversation. So I think, you know, that's really important. Populism, there was left-wing populism, there's right-wing populism. And the Democrats have always been, in recent years, have been really reluctant to embrace populism. And they're a little terrified by it, which is a shame, because, of course, back in the Depression and the years of FDR, left-wing populism ran the country, and it was a good thing. And so this populist mass is going to the right wing because they're the ones who will engage them and promise them things, not necessarily health care, but morality.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so,
right.
And that, you too can play that game, and the Democrats need to get into it. And passing health care would be a definite way.
And that's the way we stepped into the moral arena, by saying, you know, that this is something we should do. We do have one more caller here online who's holding patiently. Let's try to get to them before we close. Good morning. You're on the air. Good morning, caller. Hello. Okay, engineer is giving us the sign. Is it a kick is good? Good morning, caller.
Good morning.
Yes, how are you?
Hello, how are you? Your guest seems to make quite a bit about the definition of a word. I want to know why she refers to the Tea Party people as teabaggers, because that's a term that the left has foisted on everybody, and I think it's improper to use it.
There's certainly difference of opinion on that. I've had any number of teabaggers call themselves that with a certain amount of pride. So I suspect
because it's been shoved down their throats by the left.
Well, no, not with pride. I don't see pride being part of that if it's shoved down your throat.
I have actually heard, yes, I've had people, callers on shows, saying, yes, I'm a teabagger.
Well, okay. So, that's fine.
Work that out.
Yeah, okay. Well, you guys on the left are as bad as the guys on the right. I think you sell the general riffraff out here kind of short when you think that everybody here that is worried about, say, illegal immigration coming up here is some kind of right-wing nut.
I never said that.
No, well, you were implying it.
No, okay. She didn't imply it. And then also, don't call yourselves rabble. Why would you call
yourselves
rabble?
Because your guest was calling us I don't forget what the term was, the great unwashed, the hordes, the rural people, whatever. As far as I'm concerned, they're just, everybody is just an American. And I hate your snotty, you're snotty.
Okay, well, thank you for your call.
Thank you for your call, and I hope you appreciate your opportunity to spew your opinion.
I am sorry if he felt condescended to. I think he must have missed the point where he said that I am from that same background.
I think he did when you said that was your family. Yes.
What? Yeah,
I said when you said it was your family.
Well, I think that gets to a point, and that it's difficult to oftentimes engage people because we tend not to listen, or we tend to hear what we want to hear. So That's a challenge constantly.
And but you can also hear that this man has felt very disrespected by urban elites,
mm-hmm.
and he sees me as one, you know, because mm-hmm. I did. I got out of small town and I went to college. Did that. Guilty. And, you know, I understand where he comes from. I have members of my own family who feel very much the same way. And so I try to be very careful in the language that I use. They, you know, they are less educated. They are rural. The brown shirt horde, as I refer to it, is something very specific. It's the people who have, you know, the teabaggers, the people who have resorted to intimidation and bullying as a political tactic. And I do think that's abhorrent. Mm-hmm. And I will not hesitate to call them bullies. Right. And to say that what they are doing is antithetical to democracy. And if that shoe fits the collar, so be it. And if it doesn't, and it doesn't fit a lot of conservatives, there are a lot of conservatives of goodwill who really want to engage, you know, the finer points of health care, and there are important things to debate. We deserve a good debate. And if they want to engage that, I want to hear it, because that's what we need to have. But the ones who just come to the party to disrupt it and to make sure that nobody gets to speak, that's not democratic. Okay, that is not exercising your free speech rights. That's being a bully, and we need to make a very clear distinction.
And one of the things that you say is a good tool for that, and even though sometimes those on the progressive side seem a little dubious, is rule of law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So in other words, make sure that you report any. Well, if you are at a meeting and you're being disrupted, report it. Get the police to assist. Because, we need to use all the tools that are at our disposal.
We have good tools. We have good tools within the system that will allow us to squash it. One of the ways that we will know that we are really there is when the police work for them. But for the time being, they work for us, and we need to make good use of that fact. Anyway, go on.
All right. Well, we've got about 2 minutes to kind of finish it up. And if there's any references or articles you'd like people to read besides your own.
Okay, well, first of all, my articles were originally published at ourfuture.org. And you just put liberal fascism in there, and you'll find everything I've pretty much written on the subject, because that is my home site, and Alternet reran them.
Okay.
Other articles beyond my own.
Or writers.
I've got links to several within the context of the articles.
Okay, great.
Paxton pieces and some by Chris Bowers, a few other things that people can certainly link off to. The thing I would like to leave people with as a final thought is that this is a local fight with national implications, and this is something, so whatever you do in your own hometown or neighborhood is vitally important. It's as important as anything anybody in Washington is doing, and so we need to confront these people as bullies in our local streets, and if we do, we win.
And you're hopeful.
And you're hopeful.
I am hopeful. Right. You betcha. I believe in Americans.
And as we wrap this up, don't forget to support our legislators who are also in the fray, because you said this is a local battle, but that implies that there are other levels, and our legislators who are standing up to these people need to be congratulated and supported.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Because they are getting a lot of pressure, you know, from the teabaggers and stuff. The Democratic Party has done a really good job of educating the congressmen and senators from the beginning of the summer that these people were not a majority. However it may look when you're standing in front of them at a meeting, they are not the majority, that 70% of the country is with them. And in the end, they're not accountable to those people. They're accountable to the voters. And I think most of Congress has come back into session with that awareness, and without having had these people have a lot of effect on them, which is a great thing.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much. This has been More Talk Radio. We've been speaking with Sarah Robinson. And, Sarah, we might call you again sometime as the situation unfolds.
I'd love that. Thank you.
Thank you.
And you have been listening to More Talk Radio. Join us next week when our guest will be...
We'll be talking about Solidarity Divided, and you can find more information about our upcoming show on our website, More Talk Radio. We'll have Bill Fletcher Jr. and Fernando Gapacin, authors of Solidarity Divided, as our kickoff for the membership drive. Are you a member of KBOO? Well, you know what you have to do. Stay strong and keep us strong. And speaking of staying strong and keeping strong, don't forget to participate, whether you are a volunteer ahead of time or you engage in the annual Wellness Village and Health Disparities Conference, put on by the African American Health Alliance. And that will be Friday, October 16th and Saturday, October 17th. You can call here at KBOO Desk to find out more information, or you can contact the African American Health Coalition at 503-413-1850, and good health is for everyone. Thank you for listening. This has been More Talk Radio on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland.